The costs of doing business with the United States will drastically increase. And what is more, there seems to be no order in the disorder.
Yeah, tell me about it. That's our guy, Ursula von der Leyen, European Commission President. Sorry.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
We're doing our best.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also elsewhere around the country and the world on fine dozens and dozens of fine terrestrial and internet affiliates. I would name them all, but I've slapped tariffs on them. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. Well, a $2,300 Apple iPhone? Tariffs. Trump tariffs could make that happen, says Reuters in a news alert sent out late on Thursday afternoon. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi. Wait. $2,300 for an iPhone?
Yes. Hope your old one is holding up well. You may need to keep it for a while. That was, of course, one of hundreds, if not thousands, on Thursday of similar alerts that were, likely to drop the jaws of millions, if not hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of gobsmacked people around the globe as we go to air today. How are you enjoying Liberation Day so far? Just moments after Trump's Rose Garden announcement on Wednesday of his long-threatened global trade tariffs, taxes on imported goods that you and I and all of us will now pay, apparently, for the purchase of anything made anywhere but 100% in the U.S., at least for the moment. Just moments after that announcement, Dan Ives over at Wedbush Securities, a financial services firm which manages some $5 billion in private investments around the globe, wrote, quote, President Trump just finished his tariff speech at the White House, and we would characterize this slate of tariffs as worse than the worst case scenario. While there are many details to be worked out, he writes, and investors will focus on the specifics over the coming 24 hours, the jaw dropper was the China so-called reciprocal tariff of 34%. Taiwan at 32% is the other major one, along with the EU at 20%. Tech stocks, he wrote, will clearly be under major pressure on this announcement as the worries about demand destruction, supply chains, and especially the China-Taiwan piece of the tariffs. Apple produces basically all their iPhones in China, and the question will be around exceptions, exemptions on this tariff policy. More on that in a bit. If those companies are building more operations and factories and plants in the U.S., like Apple announced they were doing in February. In fact, as Reuters notes, China was hit actually with a 54% tariff, not just a 34% so-called reciprocal tariff, as Ives cited, because Trump had already slapped China with a 20% tariff previously. So Apple share prices, as you might have guessed, plummeted almost 10% on the NASDAQ on Thursday, just as Ives predicted was likely, equating to a loss of tens of billions of dollars in market cap for the company. And yes, for U.S. investors in Apple. And that ain't just rich people, by the way, as millions of regular old everyday Americans have Apple as part of their retirement portfolios, often whether they know it or not, as part of mutual funds that are in their 401ks, etc. Ives' overall prediction appeared to be coming true across the board on Thursday on Wall Street, which, as expected, by both Ives and pretty much everyone else who isn't in the Trump administration or in his denialist cult. Well, we all expected it, but global markets just went over a cliff in response to what amounts to Trump's trade sanctions, not simply tariffs, levied against virtually every nation on Earth, even nations and remote islands, which, yes, have no inhabitants on them. Seriously. The stock market went just over a cliff on Thursday after Trump announced this new global trade war. The market saw its worst day since 2020 when, let me check my notes. Who was back in the White House back in 2020? The same guy.
Like clockwork.
The Dow plunged more than 1,600 points, or just under 4%. The S&P 500 fell almost 5%. The tech-heavy NASDAQ plummeted almost 6% in a single day. And we do not have a worldwide pandemic to thank for all of this, but we do have Donald Trump, who was there for both of the most recent plunges in the market for some reason, and who single-handedly masterminded this one. No virus necessary. Trying to make sense of the seemingly random numbers that were used to pronounce his various tariffs on various countries kind of seems like a fool's errand today. It seems to be based on some algorithm that doesn't actually have to do with reciprocal tariffs at all, as Trump tried to claim during his weird, rambling 50-minute Rose Garden explanation, that he was simply taking tariffs that are in place against the U.S. by other countries, cutting those numbers in half, and charging that as a tariff against those nations.
If it sounds ridiculously simplistic, that's because it is.
As Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman observed, Trump's so-called Liberation Day was, quote, even worse than expected, as the numbers, he explains, simply make no actual sense, suggesting Trump has, quote, gone full on crazy. It's not just that he appears to be imposing much higher tariffs than almost anyone expected, writes Krugman. He's also making false claims about our trading partners. Not sure in this case whether they're lies, because he may be truly ignorant. But in any event, they will both enrage them and make it very hard to back down, says Krugman. Basically, he notes, he's claiming that the rest of the world is placing very high tariffs on U.S. products and that he's imposing reciprocal tariffs that are only half of what they impose on us. But that's not true, as Krugman explains, pointing to the chart that Donald Trump displayed in the Rose Garden of dozens of these countries, the tariffs that they are supposedly charging on U.S. imports. And he says, quote, it's completely crazy. Krugman focuses on Trump's claims about our friends, maybe our former friends in the European Union, which, like the U.S., has generally low tariffs. Their average tariffs on U.S. goods is less than 3%. But Trump's chart claims that the EU has a 39% tariff on U.S. goods, and then goes on to say that therefore the EU's reciprocal tariff will be just over half of that at 20%. But, you know, that having once claimed that Europe charges tariffs more than 10 times as high as reality, says Krugman, Trump will now never drop that claim. He says, I don't know how many people noticed, but he's still claiming that we're subsidizing Canada by $200 billion a year. Aside from the basic mistake of claiming that a Canadian trade surplus means that we're somehow subsidizing Canada. Yes, we buy more from them than they buy from us, because our population, for one thing, is way bigger than theirs.
Like, you know, 8 times bigger.
Says Krugman, Trump is inflating the actual trade surplus with Canada by a factor of 3 when he cites that, when he claims we're subsidizing them by $200 billion a year. He says many, many people have pointed out Trump's error there, but Trump is sticking with it the same way that Elon Musk is sticking with the millions of dead Social Security beneficiaries thing, which is also a complete lie. If you had any hopes that Trump would step back from the brink, this announcement, between the very high tariff rates and the complete falsehoods about what other countries are doing, should kill those hopes, warns Krugman. Over the weekend, White House aide and convicted criminal Peter Navarro said that he had expected Trump's tariffs to bring in $6 trillion in revenue to the U.S. over the next decade, which could, CNN notes, amounts to the largest tax hike in U.S. history. Because, yes, that revenue, if it was actually raised, would actually be paid by American consumers as an increase to the cost of goods that they purchase that come from other countries. Even when adjusting for inflation, that amount would be triple the tax increase that was put in place back in 1942 to pay the cost of fighting World War II. Navarro, however, a full-fledged made man at this point in Trump's Orwellian mob family, insisted that revenue would not be a tax on Americans, but somehow be a tax cut, echoing the Trump administration's repeated belief that tariffs will be paid not by American consumers, but by businesses in other countries or by the countries themselves. Which, no matter how many times Trump and his cult repeat it, is simply not true. So, to be clear, again, if I am, let's say, a U.S. importer and I pay $80 to import a product that I then sell to my American customers for $100, making a $20 profit, if I am forced instead to pay an import tariff of 50% on that product, well, it now costs me $120 to buy the product. Am I still going to sell it to my customers for $100 at a loss? Or am I going to raise the price to something well over $120 so that I can still make a profit? This is like seventh grade math stuff. The non-auto tariffs alone, according to Trump's trade advisor, Navarro, quote, are going to raise about $600 billion a year, about $6 trillion over a 10-year period, he said. Cars and the tariffs on those would add another $100 billion annually. It's not exactly clear how Navarro calculated this $700 billion annual figure. It's also not clear and perhaps unlikely that Americans will continue to buy as many imported goods if prices are hiked because of the tariffs. But to reach Navarro's estimate, it would take a 25% tariff on virtually all $3.3 trillion in goods that are imported by U.S. businesses and consumers in 2024. That is a new 25% tax on Americans, on American consumers. And it would be the largest such tax increase in American history. That's what happened over the past 24 hours. That was what Trump's announcement in the Rose Garden on Liberation Day is actually all about, at least for a start. Although Navarro says these levies will force automakers to shift production to U.S. plants and create jobs there, experts and auto industry executives say that that change would take years to accomplish, if it happens at all. In the meantime, thousands of U.S. auto jobs could be lost because even so-called American-made cars rely on more than half of their parts that are made elsewhere outside of the U.S. and will now, in theory, be subject to Trump's huge new taxes. I'm sorry, his sanctions. I'm sorry, his reciprocal tariffs. That could raise the price of new cars to anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000. Trump has said not all goods, however, would be hit by tariffs, only goods from countries that have what the administration considers to have, quote, unfair trade policies toward the U.S. And yes, we will still get to that in a moment, even as Trump announced on Wednesday that these penalties would apply to virtually every country in the world. Virtually. I believe that Axios was the first one to notice on Wednesday after Trump announced his enormous list of countries to be subject to these trade sanctions. Virtually every country was listed in the entire world, quote, with one notable exception, Axios observed, Russia. Go figure. Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt told Axios Wednesday that Russia was left off this list because U.S. sanctions already, quote, preclude any meaningful trade. However, they note the U.S. still trades with Russia more with them than with countries like Mauritius, Brunei, countries that did make Trump's tariff list. Go figure. Even remote island territories like Tokelau, population 1,500 in the South Pacific, and Svalbard, population 2,500 in the Arctic Circle, they were listed for tariffs. However, Leavitt noted that Cuba, Belarus, and North Korea were also not included because existing tariffs and sanctions on them are already so high. Already so high? Or is it because they happen to be good friends with Russia and its President Vladimir Putin, who, for whatever reason, Trump appears to be absolutely terrified of in every regard? Every regard. Now, including a fear of slapping him with new trade tariffs like virtually everyone else in the world, including the tiniest island nations and, yes, our theoretically very best friends. But there's a more reasonable explanation for why Trump, who is so terrified of Putin for some reason, would not want to include him and his country on this list of sanctions, not tariffs, but sanctions, yes. And it may have something to do with what our friend, longtime investigative financial journalist David Dayan, executive editor of The American Prospect, explained on this program way back in December, if you were listening carefully. Not long after Trump's reelection last year and his campaign, where he had long been threatening tariffs, not unlike the ones that he announced on Liberation Day in the Rose Garden on Wednesday. Here is some of David Dayan's explanation about all of this on the broadcast from December 4 last year.
My view is that tariffs are a tool. They are used in trade policy to try to boost the amount of industrial goods produced in the United States. And when they are targeted, when they are in service of building a certain domestic industry, they make sense. When they are across the board, and particularly in industries or with goods that are not produced in the United States and sometimes cannot be produced in the United States, like bananas, for example, we don't have the climate to make them here. That becomes purely, I would say, inflationary, because it just means that the cost of those goods becomes higher. And therefore, if you're going to try to make the same profit, the ultimate price is going to be higher. Just because tariffs are associated with Trump doesn't mean they're necessarily a bad idea. They can be a very good idea if they are targeted and they are intended to increase our industrial base. But, you know, the way that I think Trump is going about it, you got to think of these tariffs as more like economic sanctions. If you do things that we don't like, you're going to get higher tariffs. So that's not really about trade policy, right? That's really about doing what the United States says. So it's really about policing the world through economic terms. When you have a president that is that integrated in various businesses, and then all similar businesses are going to come to this president and say, give me a waiver from your tariff. I mean, the mind boggles at the potential for corruption here. Tariffs are just being used as threats, leverage, and intimidation rather than a considered economic policy. It comes down to whoever's closer to power is going to have better success in a business. And this is what oligarchies look like, right? This is what Russia looks like. If you're closer to the king, you're going to do better. I think that the next 4 years is going to reflect this tendency. He wants to use tariffs and more generally the role of the United States as an economic hegemony, use that to bully other countries to do our bidding.
As David Dayan noted again today at The Prospect in an article explaining what Trump was doing, headlined, "They're not tariffs, they're sanctions," he reiterated much of what he explained on this show months ago about how so much of this is simply used like a mobster, a mob tactic to bully people, companies, countries. He writes, "Today I'm watching the stock market plunge and the expectations for recession and stagflation rise along with everyone else. I'm aware of the Trump administration apparently using a shortcut AI formula to reset global trade imbalances and try to BS their way through the criticism." He says, "But I think we give too much credit to Donald Trump and his lieutenants when we suggest that they are pursuing a misguided trade policy or that they aren't pairing tariffs with the necessary steps to boost domestic manufacturing. Those things are true, of course. U.S. trade policy has been deeply inequitable for decades, favoring multinationals over workers and the environment, giving benefits to those corporations in free trade agreements that they could never get through normal legislative channels, and handing over economic decisions to Wall Street. But," he says, "these careful explanations, however correct, have nothing to do with what we saw on display in the Rose Garden on Wednesday, because these aren't really tariffs at all. What Trump is doing is a sanction policy, only he's doing it against the whole world all at once for the assumed harm of, quote, ripping off the United States for decades." He says it's no different from a mob boss moving into town and sending his thugs to every business on Main Street, roughing up the proprietors and asking for protection money so they don't get pushed out of business. Trump believes that the U.S. is indispensable enough that it can intimidate every country on earth by, well, asking for protection money, which would take many forms: curbing migration, taking in more U.S. farm exports or weapons systems, reducing industrial capacity in China and forcing more consumption, buying long-dated U.S. debt on the cheap, siding with a war strategy against Iran, literally anything that the White House wants. Trump now has a tool by which he can achieve whatever goals he conjures up or simply have his leg breakers beat the global economy to a pulp. It's a mentality fit for someone repeatedly linked to organized crime." Sounds about right. "Regardless of the ridiculous way the administration calculated its tariffs," writes Dayan, "it's clear that the proposed remedy for removing them is for the EU, for example, to change its laws. Trump believes that every relationship is zero-sum and transactional. There are no win-win agreements with allies. They have to suffer for us to win. And if a deal is made, it must be made from a position of strength. From Trump's perspective, he just gained leverage on every country in the world, even the ones only inhabited by penguins." The problem, though, he notes, with this logic is that America is not indispensable, and other countries have just as much ability to retaliate, forcing the whole world into recession and making it very clear who started it. But countries are not alone in the boxes. Corporations and industry sectors are as well. The phalanxes of lawyers and lobbyists who try to ease sanctions through their contacts at the highest levels of power now have a new target. Companies have been lawyering up for months in anticipation while enlisting friendly politicians for the task. The White House has fielded hundreds of letters from businesses pleading their case, and it's already working, reports Dayan. Here's the head of American Petroleum Institute, that's the fossil fuel industry's trade association, with a slobbering note. Quote, "We welcome President Trump's decision to exclude oil and natural gas from new tariffs, underscoring the complexity of integrated global energy markets and the importance of America's role as a net energy exporter." Dan says we already know where there has been some resistance from the oil and gas industry over Trump's demand to increase production, because that would lower prices below the break-even rate that makes exploration viable for the industry. He says watch for any changes in those decisions in the weeks ahead. He adds, I've only seen Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, understand this, but this is just a loyalty test for virtually every business in the nation, a universal attempt to gather protection money that he is now using against the rest of the world. And indeed, Senator Murphy does seem to get it, according to a Blue Sky thread that he posted in response to Trump's new trade tariffs late last night. The senator explained, those trying to understand the tariffs as economic policies are dangerously naive. No, the tariffs are a tool to collapse our democracy, a means to compel loyalty from every business that will need to petition Trump now for relief. He says, this week you will read many confused economists and political pundits who don't understand how the tariffs make economic sense. That's because they don't. They aren't designed as economic policy. The tariffs are simply a new, super dangerous political tool. Our founders created a president with limited and checked powers. They specifically put the power of spending and taxation in the hands of the legislature. Why? Because they watched how kings and despots used spending and taxes to control their subjects. British kings used taxation to reward loyalty and punish dissent. On a side note, by the way, do you think Trump wants to punish Vladimir Putin? Back to Senator Murphy. Our own revolution was spurred by the king's use of heavy taxation of the colonies to push to punish our push for self-governance. The king's message was simple: stop protesting and I'll stop taxing. Trump knows that he can weaken and maybe destroy democracy by using spending and taxation in the very same way. He is using access to government funds to bully universities and law firms and state and local governments into loyalty pledges. Healthy democracies rely on an independent legal profession to maintain the rule of law, independent universities to guard objective truth and provide forums for dissent to authority, and independent state and local governments to counterbalance a powerful federal government. But the private sector also plays a role to protect democracy. Independent industry has power. The tariffs are Trump's tool to erode that power and that independence. Now, one by one, writes Senator Chris Murphy, every industry or company will need to pledge loyalty to Trump in order to get sanctions relief. What could Trump demand as part of a quiet loyalty pledge? Public shows of support from executives for all his economic policies, contributions to his political efforts, promises to police employees' support for his political opposition. The tariffs, he writes, are designed to create economic hardship. Why? So that Trump has a straight-faced rationale for releasing them business by business or industry by industry. As he adjusts or grants relief, it's a win-win. The economy will improve and the dissent will disappear. And once Trump has the lawyers and the colleges and the industry under his thumb, it becomes very hard for the opposition to have any viable space to maneuver. It's the playbook for democratically elected leaders who want to stay in power forever. The tariffs, writes Chris Murphy, aren't economic policy. They are political weapons. Get it? But as long as we see this clearly, he says, we can stop him. Public mobilization is working. Today, he notes, a few Republicans joined Democrats to vote against one set of tariffs. That was Chris Murphy on Wednesday. He was citing a vote in the U.S. Senate on Wednesday that is being cited as a rare rebuke to President Donald Trump with a group of Republicans helping to pass a resolution to block his tariff on Canadian products. A resolution that was proposed by Democratic Senator Tim Kaine before Trump announced his broader trade war on Wednesday afternoon. The Senate voted 51-48 in favor of revoking Trump's Canadian tariffs for Republicans, but I should note just for now. Senator Susan Collins of Maine, Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska joined all 47 Democrats in supporting this resolution. It passed. It required only a simple majority vote. It was not subject to a filibuster, and it passed easily with the help of those four Republicans. But it is not expected to go anywhere in the House, so don't get too excited, because a simple majority could also pass it there. But Speaker Mike Johnson will do everything he can to keep this from coming up for a vote. In any event, even if passed by the House, if it came up somehow for a vote, it could be passed with a simple majority, and it probably would be passed in that case if it was allowed for a vote, but it would still have to be signed by Donald Trump, which, of course, he will not do. But the truth is, Congress can immediately put an end to all of this madness if they wanted to. If they wanted to. And if the economy continues to spiral as expected, they're going to be thinking very seriously about that, I suspect, beginning right now. As TPM's Josh Marshall explains in his newsletter today, if you're running for Congress or considering running for Congress or know someone who is doing either, this message is for you. Presidents have no power over tariffs, full stop. It's not like war powers or pardons that are in the Constitution. Trump can only do this because Congress gave presidents this power. Indeed, presidents only have the power to unilaterally issue trade tariffs in a declared emergency, according to federal law, which is why Trump declared an economic emergency in an executive order the very first day that he took office, despite the U.S. economy at the time under Joe Biden being what the Economist magazine and really everyone described as, quote, the envy of the world. And it was. Also, all of the major Wall Street indexes before Trump was won the election, they were all at record levels. If that sort of thing matters to you, they have since plummeted far below what they were even before last year's elections. As Josh Marshall explains, Congress can take back that power for the president to unilaterally issue these devastating tariffs or sanctions or whatever you want to call them. They can take that back at any moment. Given the minuscule Republican hold in the House, that means that every GOP representative is literally and personally responsible for these tariffs and their consequences. Every single one. High prices? Well, Rep. X is responsible. He or she could end this, but they are not. A 401k that might flatline before you do? Well, you can thank Rep. X for that as well. They could end this, but they're supporting it. It's crystal clear, and it has the benefit of being true. The 2026 midterms are already underway. They really are, he notes. That's the whole message. It's malpractice for anyone challenging a Republican member of Congress not to be on this today. Josh doesn't believe that the tariffs themselves will last. He argues that the pain will be too widely distributed and the ideological hold is too thin and the path to overturning them too clear. He says some have pointed out that if a statute is required to rescind or limit the president's tariff authority, what about a veto? Doesn't that mean a few votes are not enough? He says yes and no. As a technical matter, that's correct. But since taking away this power requires a law, the president could veto it. That requires overriding the veto. And as a political and electoral matter, he says that is way too far into the weeds. Let your hapless Republican member of Congress try to argue that, well, even if he voted for it to end those tariffs, Trump might veto the bill, so that's why he's going to vote against it. Good luck with that. The pressure against these tariffs are much greater than the strength of the powers holding them in place, argues Josh, saying that he believes if that pressure continues, Trump will simply lift them, that there, if it's a dam-breaking situation where everyone is going to vote rather than be embarrassed by it, he'll just end the tariffs. Because, you know, as usual, this is why he argues that, you know, anyone running for office right now against a Republican, the time to demand Congress to put the brakes on all of this is right now, right now. Which is true. And, I don't have much time, to be frank, for those who say, oh, well, you know, good luck. Democracy is over. We're never going to have an election again anyway, so he'll get away with it. Why even bother? Republicans, they're just going to make it so hard to vote, it'll be impossible to take back power from them. Yes, it is true. They will, and they have made it much harder for those who oppose them to vote. But too bad. You and I, we all got to just figure out how to overcome that, how to vote any way that we can, because that is the essential power that we have that Donald Trump cannot take away with his Liberation Day and the Rose Garden. We still have that power, even if we have to still fight for it. Yeah, Donald Trump may be acting like a mob boss and his fellow Republicans in Congress, you know, like his henchmen. But the mafia cannot be removed from power by a simple vote of the people. Republicans, those now responsible for all of this, supporting all of this, they can be removed from power by a vote of the people. And while midterms are still more than a year and a half away, they might as well just be days away for Trump's Republican henchmen right now in Congress, who are and or, if not already, certainly will be feeling the heat from their constituents about all of this, even in the reddest of congressional districts, I promise you, especially as their own constituents, their own retirement funds continue to go over a cliff and the price for everyday goods continues to skyrocket. When things get really bad, at least for me, it still and always comes down, yes, to elections and democracy. Because elections still matter more than anything else at this point. Still, in this country, even to those sycophants who are as terrified of Donald Trump as Donald Trump is terrified of Vladimir Putin. Just you watch. So let's take a break. We'll pick up on some election news that I've been trying to get to for days now. That and Desi Doyen and the Green News Report are all still ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Right on. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. And yep, as bad as it gets, and all signs suggest it's going to keep getting worse. Hang in there, because it will, I promise you, come back to the power of the people. It really will. And to that end, we got to keep fighting to protect our democracy and its voters and our right to vote, no matter how hard the villains will continue to fight like hell to oppose that right. And how hard we're going to have to fight them back in response. To that end, a bit of good news from federal courts of late that I've been trying to get to. Let's start in the critical swing state of Pennsylvania. Federal judge ruled on Monday that Pennsylvania must count undated or wrongly dated mail-in ballots, finding that a previous state law rejecting such ballots violated the U.S. Constitution's First and 14th Amendments. The ruling, according to Democracy Docket, stems from a lawsuit was originally filed in 2022 by three Pennsylvania voters, along with Democratic U.S. Senator John Fetterman and some other Democratic groups challenging the state's instructions to county boards of elections that any mail-in ballot that is timely cast but either missing a date or containing the wrong date on the outer return envelope should not be counted. If you forget to put the date on that ballot that you send in on the outside of the envelope, even though they know that it was timely cast, even if it arrives well before Election Day, it should not be counted, according to, the state board. Back then, that's what Democrats challenged.
Well, it makes sense because as a voter, you're already legally registered. It doesn't change the eligibility of you as a voter to vote in that election in that state. It's just a minor technical error that really has no bearing whatsoever on whether you are a legal voter or that's a legal ballot.
Well, you would think so. The ruling on Monday said that those ballots should be counted. That's potentially good news elsewhere, by the way, in other states that are run mostly by Republicans who also try to strike otherwise lawfully cast ballots for simple errors like this that have nothing to do with the validity of the voter or their ballot. The plaintiffs argued in the suit that not counting undated ballot mail-in ballots violates the materiality provision of the Civil Rights Act because it denies an individual the right to vote for reasons that are not material to determining the individual's eligibility. The plaintiffs argued that the date requirement is immaterial because, quote, Pennsylvania law determines voter eligibility based on the date of the election rather than the date of marking the ballot. You know, some people put their birthday on there, etc. So the date instruction provides no information about whether a voter is qualified. In her ruling, District Court Judge Susan Paradise Baxter, who was appointed by President Donald Trump in his first term, actually found that the state did not violate the materiality provision by saying those ballots shouldn't be counted. But the plaintiffs had also argued that rejecting undated mail-in ballots also violates the First and 14th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution by placing an undue burden on the right to vote. And the court in this case found that Pennsylvania did violate both amendments, quote, by imposing impermissible burdens on Pennsylvania's fundamental right to vote, burdens that are not justified by any state interest, according to the judge. Again, this is a ruling from a Trump judge. So that's good news. With the ruling, Pennsylvania can't reject any more mail-in ballots that have undated or wrongly dated return envelopes. And that will be cited in other states where that same issue comes up. There's also a similar case still playing out, however, in state court, with the Pennsylvania Supreme Court set to decide if counting such ballots violates the state constitution. We will see. We'll see if this federal ruling has any effect on that. The high court in Pennsylvania leans towards Democrats, bigly, actually, 6-2. But they have, in past, in related cases on this, ordered counties to not count those ballots. So we will see. Also, Republicans quickly appealed that federal court ruling on Wednesday from that Trump judge. So we will see more to come on that. But good-ish news, certainly for the moment, for those who care about voting rights for all. And finally, for now, this one I've been trying to get to for weeks. A federal judge in San Antonio has ruled that the state of Texas's ID requirements for mail ballots for mail ballot applications are unconstitutional. U.S. District Judge Javier Rodriguez, a George W. Bush appointee, late last month, he found that the provisions in the state's 2021 so-called voter security law, SB1, that was adopted in the wake of Trump's false claims about the results of the 2020 election, discriminate against voters with disabilities. Mail-in voters in Texas, as Texas Public Radio notes in their report, are principally people over the age of 65 and people with disabilities. Almost all other voters in the state are not allowed to vote by mail in the Lone Star State, which it has one of the lowest voter participation rates in the nation.
That's by design.
Since the 2021 law was enacted, making it even harder to vote in Texas, many voters reported having their ballots rejected because they did not provide an ID number, or the ID number that they provided on their application did not match the one that the state had on file. For example, the voters may have given their driver's license number when they registered to vote, while their thought that they gave their driver's license number, but their voter file actually had their social security number attached to it instead. And they used the wrong one when applying for a mail-in ballot. Oops, sorry.
Yeah, you picked the wrong number that we were waiting for. Guess what number it is? Oops, sorry.
That's exactly what it is. Victor Jennison, an attorney with the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund, told Texas Public Radio, quote, "The problem with that is that many Texans have more than one Department of Public Safety ID number. So the first hurdle for a voter who's applying for an absentee ballot is they may not know which number is in the election system. And if they do know which number is in the system and they put it in correctly, the election system itself may not have the number right." Jennison cited testimony at trial where the Texas Secretary of State conceded that more than 650,000 registration records in their system were incorrect. You know, like maybe there's a number in there, but it has a typo. It was entered with a typo.
A data entry typo for how many voters?
And those voters are punished. 650,000 of them. He added that expert testimony at the trial estimated, in fact, that more than 2 million people were unable to vote in Texas in 2024 because of the ID restrictions. 2 million disenfranchised voters in Texas alone. The ruling in federal court ordered the Texas Secretary of State to remove the requirement from the mail-in ballot applications. However, the ruling came just weeks before Texas holds municipal elections on May 3, so those restrictions, sadly, will remain in effect for those municipal elections, even though they are unconstitutional and disenfranchise some 2 million voters in 2024. They're going to remain in effect for now. Judge Rodriguez also struck down provisions of SB 1 that require those who assist voters to swear an oath under penalty of perjury that, for example, they understand why the disabled voter is seeking their signature on the ballot as witness. The NAACP's Jennison said, quote, "Normally when somebody says to you, 'Would you help me?' you either step up to help them or you don't. But you don't say, you know, 'What's wrong with you? Why do you need help?' You just help. And so the idea that people who are disabled must publicly explain why they're unable to vote without assistance, that is offensive in itself," says Jennison. He added that part of the oath is that the assister must swear to understand that if the voter turns out to not be eligible for assistance, then the vote could be invalidated. So he says it puts the assister in the position of having to evaluate whether the voter is actually eligible for assistance. And the word eligible is not actually defined anywhere in the statute. The state of Texas, of course, one of the most unfriendly states in the union to its voters, is now appealing the matter after that part of the statute was struck down as well. They're appealing to the very hard right Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. So we will see if the otherwise encouraging ruling will continue to stand, or whether the right wing judicial activists on that court come up with some reason to block the lower court ruling by the George W. Bush appointed judge after a full trial and evidence adjudicated and so forth. For now, however, opponents of SB 1 are applauding the decision. They call it a victory for voters with disabilities. Elsie Cook Holmes, international president and board chair of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Inc., a co-plaintiff in the case, said it really does provide an opportunity for the 3 million plus voters with disabilities in Texas to be able to exercise their right to vote without undue hardship. Judge Rodriguez previously ruled last fall that the state of Texas could no longer investigate voter assistance efforts as a criminal act, as their idiot Attorney General Ken Paxton had been doing. The state of Texas of course, has already appealed that ruling as well, naturally. SB 1 was passed in the wake of Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud without evidence following the 2020 election. Also limited, the bill also limited early voting hours, banned 24-hour voting, limited drive-through voting centers, limited drop-off locations for ballots, limited the distribution of mail-in ballot applications, and expanded the authority of partisan poll watchers. Gosh, I wonder why they're so far near the bottom of voter participation in the state of Texas. Looks like they'll remain that way, remain near the bottom of that list, those rankings across the nation for a while. But anyway, things may be looking a little bit better. And yes, elections still matter. As Desi Doyen notes as well in our latest Green News Report.
This is the highest level of risk as far as tornadoes are concerned.
Amid mass layoffs, federal weather forecasters still working to keep America safe. Massive cuts at federal agencies halt research into health impacts of pollution and climate change. Plus,
experts estimate there may be a million orphaned oil and gas wells in the U.S.
Trump administration freezes funds intended to plug America's abandoned wells.
Well, all of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
And we're opening up our coal mines again, and we're going to do, I call it beautiful clean coal. The technology is so good now. That coal can give you tremendous
black lung
power.
Oh, so close. This is your Green News Report.
At the same time, it can be very clean.
No, it can't. Okay, Desi Doyen, I know that Trump and Elon Musk have been laying off all kinds of National Weather Service staff. But right now is when we kind of need them.
Yep. Despite the Trump administration's massive staff and budget cuts to those battered agencies, they nevertheless continue to publish critical weather information, including dire warnings of major storms across a large swath of the United States in coming days, with the potential to generate significant tornadoes and, quote, catastrophic generational flooding.
They haven't killed FEMA entirely yet, have they?
Not yet.
Okay.
Extreme precipitation events are becoming more common and severe due to man-made climate change because a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture. A new analysis from nonprofit data firm Climate Central this week confirms prior research showing extreme rainstorms are increasing in frequency and intensity in all regions of the U.S. The Trump administration this week took a chainsaw to public health with massive cuts to the Department of Health and Human Services, effectively closing programs focused on pollution, like the Asthma and Air Quality Branch of the National Center for Environmental Health. At the National Institutes of Health, the administration has also halted future funding of studies and academic programs focused on the health impacts of climate change, because those are now viewed as conflicting with the Trump administration's push to expand fossil fuels. That's according to internal records obtained by ProPublica. The research programs were focused on understanding and reducing the public health consequences of climate change, like extreme heat, waterborne diseases from flooding, the long-term health impacts of wildfires, and more.
Don't even ask about food safety.
But the Trump administration's cruelest cuts have gutted the crucial low-income home energy assistance program, LIHEAP for short, and its small staff that help millions of low-income households afford energy bills and prevent utility shutoffs, ensuring that poor Americans don't die of heat in summer or freeze to death in winter.
So we've just done away with that agency?
Well, effectively, they have dismissed the staff, which has gutted the agency and made it impossible for it to carry out its work.
So the agency exists, just nobody still works there.
Sadly, yes. In other news, Congress approved billions of dollars under President Biden's Inflation Reduction Act and infrastructure law to clean up hundreds of thousands of oil and gas wells across the country that were abandoned by the companies that drilled them. Orphaned oil and gas wells leak massive amounts of the climate-warming superpollutant methane into the atmosphere. Toxic chemicals used by drillers contaminate local water sources. Here's Melissa Ostroff of nonprofit watchdog group Earthworks in an interview with PBS NewsHour.
There's no responsible party that we can hold accountable now to clean up the mess that we have here. And so it's just leaking into the air, one of these at a time.
High Country News reports that that landmark program is now frozen under Donald Trump's barrage of executive orders directing federal agencies to stop distributing unspent funds from those laws, halting the cleanup just as it was getting started. Meanwhile, up at the North Pole, the end of winter marks the peak for sea ice extent. But new data show that sea ice has hit its smallest winter peak extent on record in the satellite era, marking profound changes underway in the Arctic due to man-made global warming.
Well, let's shut down those satellites right away.
But there is a bit of good news for things that breathe in Illinois. In a city council election held this week in Naperville, Illinois, the fate of a giant polluting coal plant was on the line. Voters chose an anti-coal majority for the city council, ensuring that that coal plant will shut down on schedule, proving that once again, elections really do matter.
One election, one coal plant at a time. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
I know you're feeling like you got nothing left. Well, lift your head. It ain't over yet, it ain't over yet. So move, keep walking. Soldier, keep moving.
Keep walking.
Indeed. It shows how important it is to pay attention to elections at the local level, the state level, the county level, everywhere.
Thanks a bunch, Desi Doyen, our producer. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, want to hear it again, want to share it with someone you know, love, or hate, you can do it for free downloading it from bradblog.com. That is made available to you, to all. Thanks to those of you kind enough to hit a donate button over there or who stopped by bradblog.com/donate. You can drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On all the social medias, you will find me at The Brad Blog, and Desi is Green News Report. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Never meant it more. Good luck, world.
It ain't over yet.
No.
It ain't over yet, so get up and move. Keep walking, soldier, keep moving on. Move, keep walking, until the morning. Together.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate.